From WGCU, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Five people were killed and six more injured when a gunman opened fire at the Fort Lauderdale airport Friday afternoon. More than 100,000 people were displaced by the carnage that shut down the airport for hours. Today, the suspected gunman, 26-year-old Esteban Santiago, was in a Fort Lauderdale courtroom hearing the charges against him. Charges that could carry the death penalty. Coming up, a debrief with reporters who were in the courtroom this morning and tracing the killer's trail all the way back to Anchorage, Alaska. Plus, we'll hear from two Fort Myers nonprofits working to help veterans and active duty military address mental illness and PTSD. And as Florida's population grows, it's becoming more diverse. That's led to a number of breakthroughs for racial and ethnic minorities in elected office and other positions of power in the state. Many are coming from right here in South Florida. Ahead, a new book takes a look at Florida's minority trailblazers. But first, the news. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Capturing people's stories before they disappear is the work of historians and biographers, and getting those stories firsthand has been the work of Susan McManus. She's compiled the stories of people who have helped shape the state of Florida in a book entitled Florida's Minority Trailblazers. She's with us to talk about this tome. Susan McManus, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
It is a very long book. You can become part of our conversation with us by calling at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Or find us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. Or on Twitter, we are at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. Susan, I'm telling you, that book is no shorty. That's a long book. And there's a lot of information in there.
It took around 10 years to do it, but it was needed because when Florida was growing so fast, no one really stopped to take a look at the people who transformed Florida in terms of its racial and ethnic and partisan and gender composition. And so this book really goes back to the 1960s, the beginning of the civil rights movement, and when reapportionment took place and governments moved to one person, one vote, and follows through 50 years. And I interviewed over 51 of these trailblazers. A trailblazer was defined as the intersection of race and gender and party, so that we can look at how Florida's state government and congressional delegations have changed over this 50-year period and become more inclusive and more representative, both in terms of race and ethnicity and gender and also party, because Florida, as you know, and this last election is exemplified, is now the purplest of purple states. Just 1% has really been the margin of victory for the last four major elections in Florida, two governor's races and now two presidential contests.
It is very purple. You are not kidding. Why did you decide to just limit it to the last 50 years?
Because that's really the game that we're playing in right now. Up to that point, first of all, there wasn't a lot of minority representation, but more importantly, it wasn't one person, one vote. You didn't have districts that will equal population and composition. So even within Florida, you'd have the old panhandle where somebody representing one county of 20,000 would have the same number of votes in the legislature as somebody from Miami-Dade County. There was a huge inequity. And once the civil rights movement started and the Voting Rights Act and all the redistricting took place, which was in the beginning in the 60s forward, that's the game under which politics has been played since. One person, one vote concept dominates. And also, we've seen 50 years of transitioning of Florida from a small backwoods, kind of one of the smallest states, to now the third largest state in the country in a 50-year period.
With an intense amount of diversity.
Yes, absolutely. And this is the first work that's really looked at over time the election of people of different backgrounds in state government per se, not just the House and the Senate and the legislature, but also in the executive branch and also in the judicial branch, and then looking at how Florida has changed in its composition in terms of its congressional representation. And, of course, the bigger we've gotten, the more representatives that we have in the U.S. Congress. So this is a book about the transitioning and transformation of Florida. As the population has grown, the people who have governed the state have changed in their racial, gender, and party makeup.
What I found pretty interesting was how things have evolved, too. It went from Latino or Hispanic, and then it became splintered. You have Cuban, then you had different. Can you tell me a little bit about how that has evolved in this short period of time?
Well, of course, some of the first representatives were before the 60s, the Spanish and black representatives from the, you know, the Reconstruction period, blacks and the Hispanics, you know, formation of St. Augustine and so forth. But it's really been the fact that within both the black and Asian and Hispanic communities, that as different groups have in-migrated from other parts of the world, other countries, that's when we've started to see the politics locally change. And so today, it's really very inaccurate to describe Florida's Hispanic population as Cuban-dominated. But it was initially, because South Florida, very concentrated, large influx of Cubans who quickly got into politics. But more recently, we've seen Hispanics coming from a lot of other Latin American countries. We have Colombians that have been elected. We have Nicaraguans. We have people from Ecuador, Puerto Rico. So, and their politics are often different because the cultures that they bring and their politics, the way that you campaign, differ. Even within Florida's black community, which is not all Florida-born or U.S.-born, increasingly we've seen Florida's black population and its elected officials change, as we've seen an influx of people from the Bahamas and from the Caribbean, Trinidad, from Jamaica, from other countries as well. So you see that Florida is the most diverse country, I mean state, yes, diverse countries-wise, but the most diverse state of all 50 in its racial and ethnic composition, which is what makes the study of race and ethnicity so valuable to scholars, which it was a great place to write this book because there's no better place than Florida. And even the Asian population, we've only had two elected to the state legislature, but one from a Korean background, the other from a Chinese background. So Florida is a microcosm of the country, but certainly a very diverse place. And when they came into politics, changed a lot. So you had an influx into the Florida legislature early on, Hispanics during the 60s, reflecting a lot of the changes in the influx of people. But also you had African Americans starting to get elected in the 60s and 70s. And then when the women's movement came along, then it was about a decade later where you started seeing more women elected to office. So the time period at which different groups surface politically is very much tied to immigration patterns. And it does take a while for a newly arrived group to gel and necessary to become naturalized and then become important politically.
Well, it's interesting demographically, but it's also interesting because they're people. A lot of the information came from newspapers, public records, but the most important part of the book is the interviews. Can you tell me a little bit about some of those interviews, and are there any that stand out?
Incredible opportunity. I spent about an hour with each of the living trailblazers, and the importance of this book is magnified by the fact that now several have already passed away. But I can remember interviewing Carrie Meek, who was in her home in Miami area, being taken to her home by Corinne Brown. Both are trailblazers. Both were the first two women to be black women to be elected to the U.S. Congress from Florida. But Carrie Meek, having broken so many and cleared so many trails for other minority women, being in her home and talking, hearing her talk about what it was like to run for office when a black woman had not, and what it felt like when she was first took the oath and was in with a bunch of white males. And I'll never forget one of the comments she made to me. I said, well, how did it feel to be the first? And she says, well, I don't really take a lot of pride in being first because there should have been so many before me. And she says, but what scared me the most was feeling alone in a way, being in, used the word actually scared. She was in with a bunch of white men, a culture she wasn't familiar with, representing a group that had been so underrepresented. So that was a very, very memorable interview. But every single one of them had a dimension that was just incredibly interesting and moving. The fact that they would sit down with me for over an hour and share their stories was as you say, the most important part of this book, because capturing the hurdles that they saw that they had to overcome, what kind of dimensions racially were in existence when they were running, who helped them, who hindered them. But I ended every interview asking them what kind of advice they would give younger minorities today in terms of making the leap into running for public office or seeking an appointment to a vacant post, because a lot of minorities have entered politics that way and then gotten elected on their own once they've served. But in the courts, of course, you have the appointment process.
Yeah, that's another aspect. You have people that become trailblazers and they are elected, but then they're able to do some appointments and appointing people to a seat rather than having them win an election. So it ends up kind of being able to spread some of that diversity as well.
Right. And the reasons why they ran were varied. Some would run because they said, you know, they were just absolutely tired of their race or gender being underrepresented. Some would run for specific issues. A number of them ran on improving education in their area. Education is one of the key elements you saw among the biographies of a lot of these trailblazers. Many were college educated, but many had gotten their start, very interestingly, in a community college. I think of that on that front of Annie Betancourt, who was the first Cuban Democratic woman elected to the Florida House of Representatives. I also was invited to her home to interview her, and that was one of the warm things about many of these interviews took place in very personal kinds of settings. But she told me that she was encouraged to run. She was working for Miami-Dade Community College, which is one of the largest community colleges in the entire United States and clearly one of the most diverse. And people kept telling her, you ought to run for the legislature because you know so much about education and you know so many people in our community. And that was kind of a common story. But there was just so many uniquenesses, and I honestly, when I go back through now and read some of the narratives, I even get teary and realize the contributions that each of these people in their own way made to the betterment of Florida, which has become, again, a more diverse and inclusive state in its governance.
It's hard not to be starstruck with some of these people. I'm interested to hear about Betty Mae Tiger Jumper. Can you tell me about her?
Yeah, we really debated initially, should we put the Seminoles and Miccosukees in the book? Well, obviously they're a minority, but they have not elected someone to a state office. But in doing the research, it was so compelling, her story. She was the first chief, woman chief, not only of the Seminole tribe in Florida, but she was the first chief of any Native American tribe in the entire United States. And a fascinating story. And it is really rewarding because people who are looking at the book now, it just came out, as you know, have almost always asked the question you asked. So she's become one of the more popular figures in the book. And in the book, we talk about the influence, the growing influence of the tribes in state politics. The tribes, of course, give a lot of money to different campaigns and are very interested in certain issues, obviously gambling one of them. But it is true that it's just a matter of time before someone from one of the tribes gets elected to a state office. And she will have been, of course, the trailblazer woman tribe member for those who follow.
Well, with a name like Tiger Jumper, it's hard not to want to know what that story is about.
Absolutely.
Did you meet her in person?
I did not. She was already passed by the time that I had done the book.
Okay. Well, you had mentioned another group, African Americans, and I wanted to ask you about Haitians. You say that the number of Haitians immigrating to Florida has exceeded that of all other foreign immigrants. How much of an impact have they had?
Tremendously. In fact, it's really changed the politics of Southeast Florida. And the first Haitian to get elected to the Florida legislature was Philip Brutus from Miami Shores, and followed up by his wife, now ex-wife, Yoli Roberson, both from Haiti. They came in the early 2000s, but subsequent to that, you've had a number of other Haitians been elected to local offices down in South Florida, and you just had Haitian elected to the Florida legislature just this past election. So they have really been very successful in local politics in South Florida, but also in state legislative contests.
It seems like the majority of the people that you're talking about come from southern Florida, if not Miami, but at least South Florida.
Well, most of the trailblazers come from big metropolitan areas. And obviously, South Florida is the melting pot of melting pots, which would be Florida, of course, as a whole, but certainly there. We've also seen a number elected from the Orlando area, some from the Tampa area, as well as within the black community, a number of trailblazers from the Jacksonville area, which has a sizable black population as well.
Well, this is really an important book for you to have put together. So I would like to thank you for doing that kind of legwork. That is quite a piece of work.
It was quite tedious, but I had over 10 of my students over the 10-year period work on it, all of whom have done very well professionally and for whom I'll forever be grateful. And they are obviously the reason that I continue to be a professor, the quality of students and their interest in learning, particularly learning the diversity of Florida. It was wonderfully satisfying to work with the students.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today. We're going to have to leave it there. Thanks for coming on to talk with us, Susan McManus, about your book. It's called Florida's Minority Trailblazers, if you're interested in picking that up and getting a slice of the history of Florida. Our show today was produced by Matthew Smith and directed by Richard Chin Kui, with technical help from A.J. Leonard. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. Tomorrow on Gulf Coast Live, Florida is one of the toughest states in the nation when it comes to a convicted felon trying to regain the right to vote, and it's become even tougher in recent years. Right to vote advocates say 1 in 4 African Americans can't vote because of this, even though they comprise only 17% of the state's population. Now there is a move to make regaining those rights easier. We'll take a look at the proposal at Tallahassee and look at why regaining voting rights has become so much more difficult. Plus, if you ever wondered how long it takes for a dinosaur egg to hatch, a researcher has found out. We'll talk to the man who used fossilized cell samples to recreate a dinosaur egg and estimate how long Mama Dinosaur had to wait for it to hatch. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO, Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.